Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app. With your help, we can continue to stand up for free speech, for open debate and rational discussion, reaching new audiences and bringing important information free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Visit realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference.
It's time to cut through the spin and get to the heart of the big political issues of the week.
It's time for the Spin Cycle.
Tuesdays at 1 p.m. only on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Welcome to Spin Cycle, where we aim to cut through the spin and get right to the heart of the big political issues of the previous week. This week, we'll focus on Phase 2 of the Royal Commission of Inquiry into COVID-19, the highly contentious Treaty Principles debate, the lifting of the ban on genetic engineering and the problems with NIWA's historical storm data, and the big international issue of the anti-immigration protests in the UK and the crackdown on free speech that is being implemented in response. To comment on these issues, we'll be speaking with Brooke Van Velden, David Seymour, Winston Peters, Maori Party MP Takuta Ferris, Judith Collins, investigative journalist Ian Wishart, UK-based author and analyst Simon Elmer, and Irish political commentator Keith Woods. Last week, the government released the terms of reference for Phase 2 of the Royal Commission of Inquiry into the COVID-19 response. This was an important victory for the many people who were harmed by government policies during the pandemic, who were critical of the inquiry announced by the Labor government, and who campaigned for something more expansive. Importantly, under the expanded terms of reference, the Royal Commission will now be able to examine the really controversial issues, such as whether the vaccine mandates and lockdowns were justified, and the safety and efficacy of the vaccine. Minister Brooke Van Velden joined Paul Brennan to discuss the expanded terms of reference on Thursday last week.
Does the government accept that the authoritarian and managerial, I think that was the word used, approach taken to the pandemic damaged our social cohesion, do you think?
I think it did. I think what we have in reality is a much more divided society than when we first had COVID enter our shores. But for me, I want to look into those details of what was the government's response, why did they do it, and which particular actions led to a lack of social cohesion, so that if something happens in the future, we don't go down this route again. You know, we were responding to situations in the past. I don't want to see that happen in the future. I think we can be a much more united society. You know, if you take the issue of vaccine mandates, once again, you know, I personally know many people who were very upset that they couldn't attend their own family members' funerals. That, of course, led to social division, not just in our community, but in individual families. And that will have ramification for years for people. So let's not have policy that isn't delved into the detail so we can get it better for the future.
Couple more questions. Misinformation. That was a word bandied around a lot by the previous government. Does your government accept that it was a bad decision for that government to characterise dissent from their pandemic management as mis or disinformation? Here's another one. Was it really wise to call it a podium of truth? Kind of Orwellian, right?
Look, I'm not going to get too much into the detail about what the government believes.
You wouldn't have said that, though, I take it. You wouldn't have said with the podium of truth, would you have?
No, but what we have is the commissioners here trying to seek out what was the actual truth. And I think that's important. What we're doing here with this commission is not saying that this government or the previous government knows what the truth is. We're asking these commissioners to go away, look at the evidence, be independent, be neutral, find out what that truth is for us and come up with recommendations for how we could do it better into the future. That's the beauty of this independent inquiry. And we do need to give them the space to look at the evidence and come up with those options.
All right. And one of the key questions for me personally is around the various infringements on people's basic rights. I think they were infringed and they occurred in the name of pandemic management. Will the inquiry look at any of that? Is there anything we can do better to protect people's rights in future? For example, entrenching the Bill of Rights. Will there be any accountability if people's rights are found to be violated? There would have to be, wouldn't there?
No, what I think is really important to make very clear to anybody listening is that this inquiry is about planning for the future. It's not a court of law. And there is a big distinction there. It's not about finding guilty parties or innocent parties. It's about finding out what is the truth so that any future government can prepare for a pandemic and have a better response and outcome than the one that we've received. That's kind of where I end up with it. But what I would ensure probably will provide better help for anyone listening is that with the three commissioners that we have, they have a huge level of expertise, which I think will give assurance. You know, Grant Illingworth KC not only has been at every level of the court system, but he also is a public and constitutional law expert. So I would expect that he's coming from that view when being part of this commission anyway.
One of the most vexed issues in New Zealand politics right now is the debate over the Treaty of Waitangi. Many New Zealanders felt that under Jacinda Ardern's government, Maori were granted rights over and above those of other New Zealanders. These issues were significant features of the election campaign, and rolling back co-governance and ensuring equality before the law were important items in the coalition agreement between National, ACT and New Zealand First. In the coalition agreement, ACT also secured support to introduce a bill to define the treaty principles, which many feel judges, the Waitangi Tribunal and bureaucrats have been progressively working to expand in scope well beyond the original intent of the treaty. David Seymour joined Marie Buskey to explain the purpose of ACT's Treaty Principles Bill.
The race relation question has certainly been stoked, and not necessarily by yourself. We have seen Māori have been, well, a certain group of Māori are trying to sort of state that they have one position. And it looks like with your bill that you're just wanting to start a conversation. Have I got that wrong or have they got that wrong? What's your position on your outcomes that you want for that Treaty Principles Bill?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, first of all, the Treaty Principles have been around since they were declared to be around in 1975. And they exist in the statutes, they exist in court findings, they exist in the way the public service operates, they exist in some private organisations, say they want to follow the principles. So they exist, they're not going away, and even if we could take them out of some laws, you know, Labour in the future could put them back in a week. So you've got to do more than just get rid of them. You've got to accept that the treaty principles are a thing, they have been for 50 years. Question is, who gets a say on what they are and what they mean? Our view is that the people that have chosen them is, you know, basically the public sector, the courts, the academics, basically everyone but the, you know, other 5 million people that have to live under them. Our view is that it's time everybody had a bit of a say about what does our founding document mean to us modern New Zealanders? Does it mean a partnership between races? Because that's the popular view, that the treaty created a partnership between Māori and Pākehā or Māori and the Crown. Or is it a compact that says we all live with equal rights and the same laws? And I think it's more the latter version, but people don't like that idea. I think it's a discussion that's uneasy. Some people say it's a distraction, but actually it's a discussion that we have to have.
So after almost 200 years then, is the treaty itself becoming obsolete?
No, I think the fact is that it happened and it will always be seen by people as a foundation of our country. And I don't think we should see it as a bad thing. I mean, our country was founded on a voluntary agreement that said that we're going to have the same rights and duties, that we're all going to have the right to self-determine and hold our property and those things valuable to us we own and can keep, and that the Crown has the right to govern. The Crown is sovereign. Now, that's a pretty amazing start to a country. The problem is it has been twisted to mean something different, this whole partnership idea that says you have different rights based on who your ancestors were. And I just put it to people, there is no successful example of a society at any time in history that's done that. So look, I don't think it helps to say it's obsolete, because at the end of the day, it's not going anywhere. It does help to start saying, actually, let's honour what it actually means, that we're all equal.
So the National Party, and it looks like potentially New Zealand First, have said that they'll support up to first reading and then have not made any commitments after that. What is your goal once you get to that first reading? Is it to have this discussion openly in the House with all people involved, all parties involved with their representations behind them? Because what happens if you don't get it past that first reading? What do you hope to achieve?
Well, two things. First of all, never say never. You know, the polls say 60% of New Zealanders agree with the principles. So if that's true, then who knows, maybe people are going to change their mind on it. The second issue is that even if it only goes as far as, you know, being drafted, introduced, debated in Parliament, introduced to select committee, debated again and voted down, for the first time, ordinary people have had a say about what the treaty means. That's never happened before. It's always been decided by courts and public servants and academics, and a very narrow group of New Zealanders, and they've come up with a version that's incompatible with free and flourishing societies. So I think that actually, even if we only get that far, we'll be planting a seed that maybe the treaty could mean something much more positive and inclusive than what it's come to mean so far. And if that's right, you know, it may not be this time. It may be sometime in the future. And I'll give you an example. You know, the homosexual law reform, that started in the early 70s. You know, someone had a go at it, got shot down, had another go in the late 70s, got shot down. Finally, in 1986, the law was passed. Now, that was, I hope this doesn't take 15 years, but, you know, it shows that sometimes you've just got to plant the seed of an idea. And once that basic question, you know, what kind of state is New Zealand? Are we this sort of weird oddity at the bottom of the South Pacific, which has two different types of people according to whether your ancestors on one side of the treaty or the other? Or are we actually a modern, multi-ethnic, inclusive state with equal rights for all? If we're the latter, that's pretty exciting.
New Zealand First has pledged not to support ACT's Treaty Principles Bill past its first reading in Parliament. Many of our listeners have questioned why New Zealand First is taking this position. In this interview, leader Winston Peters explains his party's position that the treaty is, in his words, a three-clause document, and it doesn't have any principles. As such, rather than defining or redefining the principles, New Zealand First is pursuing a policy of identifying and deleting all references to them in legislation.
Let's talk about treaty principles. There are none, right?
Well, look, I go back to a thesis written in 1922 by this brilliant legal scholar and famous Māori leader called Apirana Ngata, became knighted later on, was in Parliament for almost four decades. And he and his colleagues at the time, he had poor Māori there, Dr. Buck, who was a doctor, went on to be a famous anthropologist in Hawaii. And before him, Carroll, who was the Deputy Prime Minister under Seddon. And none of them made any of those sorts of claims. Then fast forward to 1987 in the Lance case, and five judges are wrestling over this issue about principles, and none of them could agree because, let's be honest, and it's been my position for a long, long time, and I said it back in 1987, almost a lone voice, but I said if no one in the Commonwealth or in the UK or the Empire in those days or in the UK, the British Empire, was in partnership with Queen Victoria on the 5th of February 1840, how come the Māori were on the 7th of February 1840? The answer is they weren't. This is a structure that is built from a fiction, mainly derived from university teachings, and all sorts of people conveniently making it up as they go along. But when you put to them, so you tell us what the principles are, none of them can agree, because there are no principles in this three-clause document.
Is it worth, though, updating this whole treaty concept with some actual bullet point principles for clarity? Is there any point in doing that?
No, there's no point in doing that because you're actually buying into the fiction constructed by these revisionists in academia and a whole lot of people, not in number, but in the Māori world, who have used it to elevate themselves at the cost immensely of the real issues that should be addressed for Maori people, like housing, like health access, education and the chance to be the best you possibly can because you've been given the chance in terms of your training to be the best you can, and first world wages. That's what Maori want, but none of these people ever talk about that, no, because they're sitting in well-financed houses, they're sitting in well-financed jobs, and they're doing it on the backs of their people who they have neglected. And I can show you all over this country for a long time those sorts of people.
For the other side of the story, RCR spoke to Māori Party MP Takuta Ferris. Takuta took us through the Māori Party's position on the treaty principles, explaining their view that the treaty sets out a partnership between the Crown and Māori. Both sides, right here on RCR.
Just want to read out here for folks who don't know exactly. In the National Act Coalition Agreement, both parties made a commitment to introduce a treaty principles bill, as we know, based on existing Act policy and supported to a select committee as soon as practicable. And it's reported here by RNZ, democracy or co-government policy paper defines three principles to be included in the bill. I want to get your view on these principles. The New Zealand government has the right to govern all New Zealanders. That seems okay, doesn't it?
Well, under the right conditions, it seems okay. You see, but under Te Tiriti o Waitangi, it's not what Te Tiriti o Waitangi says. Te Tiriti o Waitangi says that the Crown can have the right to govern in New Zealand. It doesn't say the Crown has the right to govern over Māori in New Zealand. And if you understand the context of the time, even if you just read the preamble before you get to Article 1, you'll come to some sort of understanding that what is being proposed when the Crown is being allowed to govern in New Zealand is that they will be allowed to govern their own people in New Zealand. Now, that's a significant gift. That's a constitutional gifting.
Okay.
You know, because in the treaty is an agreement between two sovereign entities. And sovereign entities don't get to just go into another sovereign entity and do whatever it likes. That's all negotiated in agreement. That's all done diplomatically. And the agreements that achieve that for sovereign entities, even to today, these things are in action today, are treaties. Treaties are what are used to bring two sovereign entities into, you know, a contractual arrangement.
I need to understand what entities mean, the way you say it. So the entity you're talking about on the Māori side is who? The collection of signatories? Or because there was no actual entity as such, was there? As we could sort of conceive it today.
Yeah. That's what the country knows today, but there's a clear entity. It's in the very first words of the treaty. You see, the treaty is a proposal, and it is directly proposed to the chiefs of the Confederation. Those are the first words in Article 1. Okay? Ko ngā rangatira o te whakamine.
So that is the entity.
The entity is the Confederation. And the Confederation of the United Tribes, the chiefs of the United Tribes of New Zealand, are the constitutional group who signed the Declaration of Independence in 1835. So these are some of the real small things. And like, if you're asking me or people who have done a little bit of discovery into the history of the treaty and its history, one of the things you learn quite quickly is that there is a defined group. So there is a sovereign group to whom the treaty is being proposed. You know, this is sort of, it's Treaty 101 in 2024. You know, the sad thing is not enough people know. So there is a sovereign group. There is a sovereign group. The treaty is addressed directly to them, and an agreement is struck one sovereign group to another, i.e. the Confederation of Chiefs, Te Whakamininga, their name in Māori, and the Crown. So the treaty isn't just being proposed willy-nilly to any chief in New Zealand. It's being proposed to the group who asserted their sovereignty internationally in 1835, and that was recognized by the British Crown. So 4 years and 3 months later, when the British Crown shows up offering its next proposal, it's not a new thing. And they know that it needs to be addressed to the Confederation of Chiefs. That's why it's in the preamble. That's why the Confederation are the first thing mentioned in Article 1.
You're listening to The Spin Cycle, the RCR breakdown of all the biggest political stories of the week, every Tuesday at 1 p.m. only on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
In mid-August, Paul sat down with the Minister of Science, Innovation and Technology, Judith Collins, to discuss the government's decision to overturn the ban on the use of gene technology outside of laboratory settings. The lifting of the ban signals a significant shift in New Zealand's stance to genetically modified organisms, the use of which had been banned for 30 years. Proponents of lifting the ban argue that it will allow New Zealand to use exciting new technologies that have the potential to boost productivity and economic growth and also help address other problems, such as climate change. They claim that New Zealand is falling behind our trading partners, who now allow the use of this technology, and that it risks undermining the long-term competitiveness of our primary industries. Critics, on the other hand, argue that the long-term risks of these technologies are still unknown, and that they may have the potential to harm the natural ecosystem, including New Zealand's organic sector, harm human health, and risk allowing the food production system to fall into the hands of large multinational biotech firms who have little concern for the well-being of New Zealand or New Zealanders. During the interview, Paul and the Minister also touched on claims by investigative journalist Ian Wishart that NIWA's historical storm data and forecasting are below par.
Just looking at organic exports, valued at around $560 million, have you engaged with the organic sector?
Yes, well,
given that's a growing sector.
There are a few. They're actually 0.87% of our primary products exported. They're a teeny-weeny tiny bit, but they're very important. And for those people who wish to buy organic produce, they can, and they can also sell it. The organics industry is not affected by the non-organic farmers who are right next door to them because there are always tolerance levels in the organics and certification. It's the same with this. It's no different from any other, different food chain or supply chain. And as I keep saying, if England can do it, Australia can do it, the US can do it, Canada can do it, Colombia can do it, Argentina can do it, China can do it, Japan can do it, and the EU is moving in with this same, very similar legislation, except apparently more liberal. Actually, I reckon we could do it.
What if they're all wrong?
Well, they're not, and that's really clear.
Okay.
So if you say something like, let's just give an example, a really practical example. So we had Cyclone Gabrielle that took out all those apple orchards and other orchards in Hawke's Bay. Those poor orchardists have to wait at the moment between 6 to 7 years after planting, replanting, to wait for their apples to grow. We've seen today work in the plant and food research where they can actually produce these apples, apple trees, within that can be fruiting within a matter of months, within a year, basically back operating. The difference if you're an orchardist with no income for 6 or 7 years as opposed to waiting a matter of months is an enormous difference. It's the difference between you losing your entire market share and another country coming in with theirs. And that's one of the things that this actually does. And it also things like blueberries, all sorts of other things. And, of course, nobody needs to buy them. They can just stay with the traditional ones if they want.
Yeah, but when the cat is out of the bag.
No, don't give me that, Paul. You're talking about if just about every country we trade with uses this, is exporting it. You know, the US is the largest exporter of food in the world. They're also the largest exporter, a producer of organic food in the world. So, you know, look, seriously, this is 30 years technology and we're catching up.
Are you telling me that apple trees can grow from nothing to fruiting apples? And how long did you say?
Basically within a year, so it's a matter of months that they're actually growing. And, of course, apple trees are grafted always, so that's how you do it. There's lots of other things like that, but we can't use that technology at the moment. We can't even put it in out in a trial in a field or a paddock or an orchard somewhere, but it's in the lab, and we saw some of the evidence of it today.
Back to, you mentioned Australia. The Office of Gene Regulation Technology there is to be copied here, right?
Well, not copied, but very similar. But we learnt from, they've suggested some amendments, which our people are taking on board. And we have the other matter, of course, that we work under the Treaty of Waitangi principles, and that we make sure that we include those particular areas, you know, include Māori advisory panel as well.
I want to ask you about Niwa. Ian Wishart has been doing some pieces, and he says you were misled by Niwa in their data that they told you. You got any comment to make about that?
Well, I don't accept it. I have to accept what NIWA's advised me, and there's no reason for me not to. I think it's really important to understand that people sometimes see conspiracies, while others of us will say that's the data that there is at the moment. And NIWA has been very, very forthright in its view that it did not mislead me, and I simply have to accept that, and I haven't seen any real evidence other than Mr. Wishart's statements.
Well, he says historical data was missing in plans for big floods, and that they had excluded 1800s and 1900s data that clearly showed that those type of floods had happened before, yet their data started in the 1960s. So what use is NIWA if it doesn't even have a full set of data to work from?
Well, NIWA's a lot more than climate change and climate issues. It also has many other areas of work that it does. But look,
like
this,
what?
This is going down a rabbit hole stuff, honestly, Paul.
11 people
NIWA
died.
NIWA have the information it has. It's provided that information. I've relied on the information. If it's wrong, it will need to correct it. But I haven't seen that yet, and they would need to front up with it. I mean, look, I'm not the expert on weather, and I don't know too many people who are other than those at NIWA and Met Service.
So what other activities does NIWA do?
Well, it does things around the sea. I mean, it has does a lot of research at sea, certainly around oceans, Antarctica, things like that.
Yeah, what do they do in Antarctica?
Well, a lot of science. So, you know, it's atmospheric, it's weather, but it's also things like they look at what's happening with currents, all these sorts of things. They have a lot of work that they do that is not solely about predicting the weather.
Yeah, but when it comes to lives lost and you've got missing flood data, for example, 41 and 53 they didn't have in their database.
41, 53, what's that? 1941.
1941 and 1953, yeah. I should have put the 19 on the front of it. They didn't have it in there. Maybe if they did have it in there, they could have given a better warning.
Well, maybe. It was certainly, you know, asking for any evidence that they misled or that they didn't have for some particular reason. 1941, I mean, frankly, we were at war. 1953, can't tell you what was happening there. I think sure we were at war.
We were
at war. It's Korean War. We were there. I'm not sure quite
what's that got to do with the war?
I don't know quite what the reason is, but I do know that that was maybe wasn't the, you know, wasn't something that NIWA had at that time. And
Ian Wishart found it in the newspapers.
Yeah, well, good.
Yeah. So you're confident that everything you hear from NIWA is okay?
Well, at the moment, I'd need to see otherwise. And the fact that it's been a newspaper doesn't necessarily mean that NIWA had it at that time.
Wouldn't you be curious if you were a weather agency serious about that? You'd know off by heart the historical data on that, or you wouldn't have the confidence to pronounce about it.
Well, I think this is something that you need to have a discussion with NIWA about. This is operational.
They don't talk.
That's very operational, and frankly, it's ridiculous asking me about those details.
Well, if you're confident with what they tell you, yet they've left a whole lot of data out, it's fair enough that I ask.
Well, you ask, but I don't have that detail. You'd need to ask them.
Following the interview with Minister Collins, RCR spoke again to Ian Wishart to get his response to the interview. Mr. Wishart believes that there are serious questions outstanding about NIWA that the Minister is refusing to address directly, and that NIWA's shortcomings cast doubt on New Zealand's climate change modelling and the storm and flood preparedness of our local councils.
What did you make of what Judith Collins had to say? And mainly, you know, obviously I referenced the detail that you've given us and our listeners over the time. Re-NIWA, your off the top of the head kind of impression to start.
Well, I almost sprayed coffee all over my computer keyboard as I was listening. It was not only one of the best interviews I've heard this year, but it was also hilarious. The stage when she invoked fighting Hitler and the Hun as a reason for having records of the 1941 or 1953 flood events in Hawke's Bay. was just stellar radio. It really was. I think what that interview illustrates is that the minister is not up to brief on this and she's not on top of her game.
I wonder how we explain that. She may have thought that, hey, it's RCR, they're kind of crazy, this should be an easy ride. Or, again, there's some hallowed status that NIWA has where no one can criticise them, question them. It pays to be kind of ignorant about what they do. What are your thoughts?
Well, you have to wonder what the NIWA satellites are focusing on, whether they have hidden secrets of all their politicians. But seriously, the reality of this is that Judith Collins and the government have been taking some heat for a couple of days now on this. She knows that at any moment in time, any journalist, theoretically, can jump out of a bush and question her about the NIWA missing data and the centrist stories. So she should have been prepared and up to brief. And her office, to be fair, as I've just released in an open letter yesterday, was warned on July 24th when the Gabriel Flood Review came out that the Flood Review contained some damning criticism of NIWA and its systemic failures. And we put that to her office for comment, including explicitly the 1941 and 1953 floods, something that you questioned her on, and that she seemed so surprised to hear about. Email sent to Judith Collins directly and to her media staff. For her not to have an answer at her fingertips for you when you asked her the question yesterday was, in my view, outrageous. It shows that she hasn't read the evidence. She hasn't been briefed. She hasn't bothered to read the report into the deaths of 11 people caused by systemic failures in part by NIWA. So this has escalated into a real problem for Judith Collins when it didn't have to be. Essentially, it boils down to this. What good is NIWA if they don't have all the historical data and current data in one place that they can drag up at a moment's notice and say, here's an incoming cyclone or storm. This is what that region has experienced in the past. This is how bad it can get. This is what we need to do. They can't do that because their main climate database that Judith Collins is so proud of is a dog's breakfast. And in the Hawke's Bay, it didn't go back before 1960. Well, there were about eight floods between 1893 and 1960 that they missed. And all of them, or a large number of them, were bigger than Gabriel. So the issue is, how does that impact on NIWA's research in other areas around New Zealand? People listening to this in Northland and Westland, Canterbury, Hutt Valley, basically anywhere where there's low-lying land is susceptible to flood. If NIWA's research on the Hawke's Bay region with known massive floods is so shonky that it caused billions of dollars worth of property damage and allegedly was a contributing factor to the deaths of 11 people, including a baby. If their research is so bad in that regard, are we really expecting to be much better anywhere else? What other time bombs are waiting down the traps for us? That's the problem. And that's the question people should be asking, because local councils are relying on NIWA or other agencies to do climate research. And NIWA's climate research is degrade, in my view. It is absolutely shocking. The Gabriel Hawke's Bay response was a disaster that didn't need to happen. Sure, you can't stop a storm from coming in. You can't stop it from dumping large amounts of rain. But you can have institutional knowledge in place that says, we've had floods that have raised the river levels by 16 metres in the past, and pretty rapidly. In fact, we've had the same amount of rain that Gabriel dropped in a couple of days has been dropped in about 9 hours in the Hawke's Bay. So it can be basically effectively twice the level of rainfall that they experienced in Gabriel. So it has a history, and they've forgotten the history. It's basic. And for Judith Collins to be dodging that, not be up to brief, not able to answer questions, and to show contempt to the people of Hawke's Bay by not even reading the flood report that says NIWA had a systemic failure, I think it raises major questions. I mean, I don't want to be the person sitting here begging Judith Collins for the sake of begging Judith Collins. We gave her every opportunity to comment. We gave her information in advance of publication seeking comment on the specific allegations. That was her chance to read the evidence. That was her chance to say to NIWA, you're not telling me the truth.
You know, worst case, computer modelling so far has driven a lot of the alarmism around coastal adaptation and managed retreat, and it's based on computer modelling, and that's like a front for this effort, let's say. So, you know, what are they really there to do?
Well, to give you an example, NIWA said
in its flood risk analysis that an event like Gabriel is a 1 in 1,000 year
yeah.
event.
1 in 1,000. Yeah.
1 in 1,000 year event, and councils are required to plan for a 1 in 500 year event. Okay, so a much lower level. In actual fact, what the Gabriel Flood Inquiry found is that when the historic records are taken into account, the Gabriel Flood might in fact be a 1 in 50 year event.
Yeah.
So that's the level of incompetence from me.
It's a big
that's
diff. The level of incompetence. Big
that's
diff.
The level of incompetence. It is. It's huge. And that's the level of incompetence that Judith Collins is defending. I mean, I, as I said, I published yesterday an open letter on Facebook to Judith Collins and her press team. And I said to them, I reminded them of a comment I made in one of the emails after they initially tried to defend Neil's position. And I said then that this could be the first case of a ministerial ship choosing to go down with sinking rats. And this is exactly what seems to be happening. The minister has all the powers at her disposal to say to Niwa, you misled me and through me the New Zealand people. There needs to be accountability, but she's not doing that.
Big names and big stories from a big week in politics. Every week with a new guest host every Tuesday at 1 p.m. This is The Spin Cycle, only on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
The big international story in recent weeks has been the protests and unrest in the UK following a mass stabbing by the son of Rwandan migrants, where 3 young British girls were killed and 8 others injured. The stabbing set off nationwide protests against the UK's mass immigration policy, and that loomed large in the recent UK election, and that many analysts consider is responsible for high housing costs, failing basic services, worsening social cohesion, and rising rates of violent crime. Compounding the problem has been the reaction of new UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer, who responded to the protests by cracking down, attempting to limit freedom of speech on social media and elsewhere, and refusing to acknowledge the protesters had any legitimate complaints. To discuss these issues, Breakfast spoke to UK-based author and analyst Simon Elmer.
At the current levels, by 2015, the native population of the UK, people born here, will undoubtedly be a minority in their own country.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to happen across most Western countries, because it seems that this is the UN document. What I think is interesting is, you know, this is a United Nations document. A lot of people have seen it. And it corroborates this idea, among Western countries, that the people are being replaced in their own country. Now, you've probably heard of this. I'd heard of it as well, that there's something called the Great Replacement.
Yeah,
and
heard of that.
It's denounced on Wikipedia as, this is the quote, as a white nationalist, far-right conspiracy theory. It turns out it's not a conspiracy theory at all. It's actually a United Nations policy. Let me just get this. Despite the evidence of this, the evidence both of the document itself and that it's this which is determining UK and also Western immigration policy. In March of this year, the UN, so the same body that published this and is implementing this, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, he's an Austrian lawyer, Wolfgang Türk. He was personally appointed to the position by the UN Secretary General. He described the Great Replacement theory as a conspiracy theory. We've heard that again, obviously.
Yeah.
But he also went on to call it delusional, racist, as a war on woke, as a war on inclusion. And he also said, and this is the really threatening point, this is where he joins hands with Keir Starmer, who himself, of course, is a lawyer. He says it directly influences perpetrators of violence. So you and I, by talking about this, of talking about this idea, which is not an idea, but which is a policy, which the data supplied by the governments back up, we, by discussing this, are perpetrating violence. And he finally asserted that something which is not true, that multiculturalism is the history of humanity. In the UK, the kind of levels of, well, not now, but even when immigration began to increase to large numbers, didn't begin until 1948. And even then, it was kind of tiny figures to what we're seeing now. The dangerous thing, I think, for us is the sort of rhetoric describing what is obviously a policy document. But this man is lying. He's quite clearly lying. And yet he's one of the most senior lawyers in the United Nations. That's the sort of rhetoric you're used to hearing from, you know, people on demonstrations holding up placards saying, refugees welcome here, you know, we must smash the far right. Anyone who opposes immigration is a racist. But this is being repeated by a very senior jurist at the United Nations. And I think the fact that he's threatening, he's basically making a veiled threat, or not so veiled threat, that anyone who discusses this is inciting violence and therefore can be arrested on a charge of hate crimes and prosecuted under this legislation. I think this is a measure of how much the people behind this, the United Nations and also the national governments which are implementing it, how forcibly they want to bury this document and bury these ideas. And it's for that reason that it's very important that we talk about them. This is policy, yeah. It is happening. And the thing about this UN paper is it's, as I said, I described it as an accountant's balancing act to address the threat to the profits of the international corporate sector. It doesn't take account of the cultural, social, and political consequences of mass immigration to such an extent that native populations are actually going to be replaced in their own country in a very short period of time. And that's what we're kind of, what's the fallout we're seeing now. And when we think about Keir Starmer's in this country, his reaction to this, you know, he just went to Northern Ireland.
I've seen his comments, yeah.
And he denounced, you know, the entire Irish people effectively as racist for being concerned about these levels of immigration into the country. In the Republic of Ireland, it's even worse. I mean, it's quite extraordinary over there, and there's an enormous amount of concern over there. This is how our leaders are going to respond to this. They're going to crack down on us, and they're going to describe anyone who wants to even discuss this as racist, but more importantly, as inciting violence.
Yeah, which is a pass to do anything in response. Totally get that. Is there a link then, and that's really great information, thank you. Is there a link then with increasing crime? Because that seems to be a perception as well. And, of course, there have been those terrible acts of, murder. I don't need to describe them specifically. They're too traumatic to talk about, actually. But you know what I'm talking about. Is that a perception? Or has the crime rate gone up with the immigration rate? Is there anything there?
Yeah, there is. I was looking at, this is the next thing you have to kind of research. This is a parallel set of figures. And this is when we get into dangerous territory because you remember under lockdown or when the vaccine program was wheeled out across the world and people started to see the damages it was causing. The response of the government and the media was this thing called correlation without causality.
Yeah.
There's a correlation between deaths following vaccination with these experimental gene therapies, but you could not prove causality. So I'm going to present these figures, and I think it's up to listeners, other people, to say whether there's definitely a correlation. Is there a causality? I think I'll leave it up to our lawyers to decide that, because I don't want to get myself into trouble. I think one of the most interesting figures I saw, in 2004, the government of Tony Blair, our new Labour government, who really kick-started, when he came in 1997, he formed a government in 1997, immigration in this country was about 50,000 a year. It immediately increased to about 150,000 and sat at that point. Most of that was coming from the European Union. In 2004, not all of it, obviously we've always had large amounts of immigrants from India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and so on. In 2004, the European Union was opened up to Eastern Europe as well. That is, seven countries from Eastern Europe, Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, Slovakia, etc. They were then given the right to come and work in the UK, and a large number arrived. Between that period, 2004 and 2013, crime in the UK actually lowered. It actually went down. So there's absolutely no correspondence there between immigration and crime. I think at the moment we've got something like 860,000 Poles or something like this in here. Now, interestingly, all these countries, Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Slovenia, they've all got a crime rate less than the UK. It's actually lower, which might have surprised a lot of people, but it actually is. Since 2013, though, crime rates in the UK have consistently gone up. One of the things is I said before that since 2016, there has been an emigration of European Union nationals out of the UK, and this has been compensated for by the government by opening up the UK to immigration from what are all these countries I mentioned, these seven countries. They're all part of the Commonwealth, which is kind of a legacy of the British Empire.
Yep, we're so part of that.
Yeah, you're part of that. Sorry, of course you are, mate. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Last time we looked.
So they got the right. They got the right to come here and also to vote here as well, interestingly. So it's going to change the political landscape as well.
Immigration is an issue not just in the UK, but also in many European and Anglosphere countries. Irish political commentator Keith Woods, who was recently named as one of the 200 most important social media influencers, is a leading voice on social media bringing attention to these issues. He joined Dewa De Boer on The Dialogue for a discussion.
Yeah, well, I guess the pattern in most kind of Anglosphere Western countries since COVID has been mass immigration really going into overdrive. You know, if you look at any English-speaking countries, Canada, the UK, they've just massively ramped up immigration since COVID. And that's partly, you know, kind of economic reasoning that they wanted to boost the economy by flooding it with low-wage workers. But Ireland is the worst case of that because we've actually had like a record population growth. Ireland's population grew by 3% last year through immigration alone, which is just unprecedented, you know, over 150,000 immigrants for a country of 5 million. And there's no sign of it stopping. And at the same time, there's, as well as that, legal immigration. And there's a lot of illegal immigration through the asylum seeker system, which has become very abused in recent times. You know, it's now the norm that people show up from countries like Nigeria, Algeria, Georgia is one of the top ones, Albania. And they say the word asylum, and then they're part of this asylum seeker process. And they have realized over time that Ireland deports very few people. Most people that use this system are scammers. They're illegal immigrants. They would not be able to immigrate legally. And so they go through this process. Many come on commercial flights, and then they destroy their documents on the plane. So the system is being totally abused. And because those numbers have gone up so much, and this was in tandem with taking a lot of refugees from the Ukraine war. So all these things kind of hit at once, massive legal immigration, the Ukraine refugees, and then the tens of thousands of people arriving trying to scam the asylum seeker process. And so the government began building these migrant centers around Ireland to house these so-called asylum seekers. And as policy, you know, they try and spread it out through the country. So they're putting it in small rural towns. They've put them in the west of Ireland. They've put them in Connemara. They've put them in working class areas of Dublin that really can't cope with this influx. And that's the main thing that's caused a huge response. You know, there have been attacks on these asylum centers. There have been massive protests since 2021. And that has led to a kind of organic sort of working class led movement to push back against this. But again, there's no sign of this stopping. Every establishment party is very committed to mass immigration agenda. And so, yeah, it's kind of bringing things to a head in terms of the pushback and the government pushing on with it. And it's kind of brought immigration front and center as an issue here.
And it's very interesting. Some of that is similar to New Zealand in that we had very high rates of immigration as well, close to 3%, just like you have. But the big difference in New Zealand is that there's no illegal immigration, basically very few asylum seekers, although that has increased. I've just seen those figures last week. But we also have a large number of people leaving the country. So we have a massive amount of population replacement going on here in New Zealand. So I think nearly 5% of the population arrived in the last 12 months, but at the same time, about 2% of our population left, and then you get about 3% growth. So it's a massive sort of churn of people based on this immigration policy. Do you see something like that in Ireland as well, or is it largely the Irish people are staying, they're not like fleeing Ireland, sort of like we're seeing in New Zealand?
I mean, historically, Ireland has always had a lot of immigration because our economy has not been in line with the rest of Europe. And that happened again with the 2008 financial crash. You know, Ireland was especially kind of over-leveraged for that. And a lot of people, especially in the construction sector, immigrated to places like Australia. But in the last few years, you know, Ireland has had a very strong economy in many respects. There's been, you know, a lot of it doesn't translate, but there has been a lot of job growth. And so that's slowed down a lot. But yes, we still do lose a lot of young professionals. You know, there are millions of Irish people around the world, of course, through previous waves of immigration, and still there are many young Irish people working abroad. So yeah, if you know, if the government was embracing immigration to fill some kind of labor gaps, you know, that's an option that's there. There's always a lot of expats that actually want to return home, but it's never been government policy to try and encourage that, because of course the worldview they have, you know, importing Nigerians or Algerians is just as good as bringing home Irish people.
And what is the pushback on the ground like? I've seen that you've got a number of different nationalist movements in Ireland. How organic is the movement that you've got? How grassroots is it? And are there big problems with factionalism? I think many countries across the West have that, where you have a lot of different right-wing factions, but very little in terms of having the ability to put aside your differences.
Yeah, it's very organic. I mean, it really kicked off in terms of being this people's movement with place called East Wall, which is a very working class area of Dublin that was taken one of these centres. And that's where there was real community pushback, you know, huge crowds coming out protesting this. They were doing kind of peaceful civil disobedience, blocking off roads. One of the men that led it, Malachy Steenson, was actually a former leftist community organiser. So, you know, it kind of shows you the background of working class people that have been involved in things like trade union politics, working class politics. And that really just spread to the rest of the country. A lot of people have kind of taken that model of peacefully protesting and forming these community groups. So it is very organic. You know, the media here, of course, as is always the case in any Western country, we're just pushed back against immigration. The left wants to pretend that they're the anti-establishment force, that they're fighting some shadowy forces of billionaire fascists or something. And they have, of course, tried to cook that narrative up in Ireland. Mostly by saying that this is some kind of foreign import, that somehow, you know, opposition to mass immigration is something that's related to British nationalism, or, you know, it's more like Tommy Robinson than anything native. You know, it's kind of absurd stuff. But yeah, it's really undeniable. You know, there hasn't been any support from establishment political parties. The media has been very critical, and it's really endured through, you know, people power, through use of their own social media channels and so on. As far as factionalism, yeah, I mean, that's the problem, really. It's always been a problem, especially in Ireland. I mean, you go right back, you know, when we were even dealing with foreign invasions, we had this problem of not really being a united Ireland, you know, with the different clans and so on in conflict. And sometimes we played off against each other. So that's, you know, infighting is a very European thing, but it's especially a very Irish thing. And, you know, the problem really is that it's not translating to electoral politics right now. You know, the ideal thing would be that you have this people's movement, you have this angst about immigration. The ideal thing would be that there's one political movement that's all that it all gets directed into. But of course, there is a lot of factionalism. There's too many different groups, competing egos, whatever reason you want to put it down to. We saw that a little bit. We had European and local elections here recently, and that was a problem. You know, you had some constituencies where you had maybe 16 people running for European election, and maybe like seven of the field were basically anti-establishment candidates, nationalists, or anti-immigration at least. And it was one of those situations where it's like, well, if it was just one guy and all of those other seven were supporting the one guy, and you break down the votes of what everyone got, there could have been like 20%. There could have been enough to get European candidates elected. Same in some of the local areas. There were a few nationalist councillors elected, but again, oftentimes there was constituencies where there was two, three people running against each other, splitting the vote. So that's something that's being worked on. You know, recently the National Party here, which is the main nationalist organization, made an agreement with two other groups, Ireland First and the Irish People, to cooperate more and to at least collaborate in terms of not competing for the same seats. So it has been a problem, but it's something that's been recognized, especially after the last election. There was a feeling of, you know, let's put maybe pettier differences aside and work together for a general election that's upcoming. So it's probably always going to be a problem to an extent. You know, you're always going to have this constellation of different types of people that are opposed for different reasons. But yeah, hopefully the proper leadership will emerge. And I think if there's real political success from a political group, then more people will fall in line.
That was Irish political commentator Keith Woods speaking to RCR's Dewa De Boer about the problem of mass immigration and the entrenched anti-white attitudes of the political establishment in Ireland, the UK, and many other Western countries. My name is William McGimsey, and I've been your host this afternoon on The Spin Cycle.
You've been listening to The Spin Cycle, the RCR breakdown of all the biggest political stories of the week, every Tuesday at 1 p.m. only on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.